Welcome to the Netzpolitik podcast. My name is Markus Beckerl. My guest today is Julian from WikiLeaks. Hi.
G'day.
What is WikiLeaks?
WikiLeaks is an uncensorable platform to help investigative journalists and whistleblowers get out primary source documentation, which is classified, confidential, or otherwise legally injuncted to the public, and also to analyze that material.
Why do we need it? Or why does a whistleblower need WikiLeaks and not his own blog?
Well, experience shows that if whistleblowers simply put legally injuncted material or material that is from their workplace on their own blog, they are fired or they have some action against them, legal or internal. And if they have an anonymous blog, that the hosting providers of that blog simply cannot be trusted to keep their anonymity. They cannot be trusted to resist legal attacks. They do not have experience in resisting legal attacks, and also technically they cannot be trusted to make a system which doesn't record information about where the whistleblower is coming from and other key identifying details. Also, there are many dangers to whistleblowers in the data that they submit. So metadata in PDF and Word documents has revealed the true identities of a number of sources. We take care of making sure that the information is stripped out. Also, in terms of impact, if someone just puts something on their blog, it's going to be quite hard for them to get this into the mainstream media. WikiLeaks is reviewed daily by hundreds of journalists and investigative organizations to see what material comes up. So it's much more likely that a document leaked through WikiLeaks to the public will have political impact.
And why are you trustworthy for a whistleblower?
Well, that's quite an interesting question. Also, we have certain legal and technical expertise, but to some degree, anyone could say that. And in our case, I guess the proof of the pudding is in the eating, that over the past year and a half of publishing many, many thousands of secret documents, not one of our sources, to our knowledge, and we try very hard to know, has ever been exposed, ever been prosecuted, or ever had anything harmful happen to them. There have also been a number of serious publicly documented legal attacks on us. We have about one a month, and we have defended against all those attacks successfully. So our protective abilities are a measure of public record. Of course, maybe nothing is infallible, but we try very hard, and so far we have been extremely successful in both protecting people and keeping information up and before the public in such a way that it will have political impact.
Are there any known funding organizations, or is there a legal entity behind WikiLeaks?
There are several different legal entities. It's best to describe WikiLeaks as an international consortium or collaboration. So the Sunshine Press is an example. There's many other organizations have contributed, lawyers, ACLU, EFF, Ralph Nader, Citizen.org. There's other affiliated groups, Index on Censorship, and many journalists operating in their own capacity, some working as part of their newspaper to assist us. That structure is what makes us, to some degree, legally immune. Because while one of these component elements can be attacked legally, if they are forced to do something, the others will simply remove them from the consortium. So this is this sort of internationalism amongst the WikiLeaks constituents has proven to be very robust in resisting court action.
What is the process if someone comes and gives documents to WikiLeaks? How do you find out if it's coming from a propaganda from a country, or how, if it's true?
Yeah, so pretty interesting question. This is often the question first on everyone's lips. How do you know that that document is true?
Well, if you've been an investigative journalist a while, and you've dealt with many, many leaked documents, you actually get a sort of gut instinct for this, which is you look at what the economic cost would have been in making a large document. As an example, we released 2 Guantanamo Bay manuals. It would have been an enormous economic cost to fabricate those manuals. Then how easy is it for someone to check? That is, could the purported authoring organization simply deny it? Or would that denial, if made erroneously, be found out later? And then there is looking at the motivation. So is it worth that economic cost to put in a false document? And looking at these things, looking at metadata information, looking at how easy the document would be to falsify, and in some cases checking with the original organization, leads us to a position where we can say we believe the document is very strongly likely to be true, or we are almost as certain as you can be in life that the document is true. So far, as far as we know, and once again we try hard to know, we have never released a fake document without saying at the time that it was fake. Sometimes we, maybe 5 or 6 occasions, we have released a fake document that was influencing the political process somewhere. So often in African elections there will be a document circulating, and we'll release this document and say, we believe this is fake and here's our analysis, and we invite other people to have some analysis of this. Anyway, not the big issue people think it is. And that's surprising, actually, to us.
Do you have any numbers or statistics? How many documents you get and how many do you release?
Yeah, so it's hard to count, because do you count pages? Do you count whole documents? What about an archive of 1,000 documents all related to one subject? So we're not sure. We have at least one, when we did count about a year ago, at least 1 million documents. I'm not sure how many of those have been released. It's substantially less. The reason that we have received more than we have released is there are many sort of formatting conversions to be done, or summary descriptions. If you just dump enormous archives on the public and on the press, what happens is that the noise drives out the signal. So they don't have a political impact. So actually we need far more people to go through our documents and write summaries and place them in a political context, so they will have a political impact. And also to help us with the presentation technology, because different formats of documents or different archives have ways that different formats of documents and different archives have ways that that they need to be massaged in order to be effectively presented. So from a PDF to a .doc or something like this, or a zip archive, these need some way of having them displayed so people can search them, as an example, for keywords, so Google can find them, so if they're not too large. It's actually a lot of work involved in working out how.
After we had a small break here, how can people contribute to WikiLeaks?
So there's the obvious contribution of getting source material. And most people in their workplaces have, on occasion, access to something that is important. But also their relatives and sisters, contract workers often have access to important documents for a limited period of time. Computer hackers, police, people working in the court system, parliamentary staffers, all these people have access to documents that should be leaked.
and also their relatives and their friends. So that's a very important contribution. Then the analysis of that material, placing it in political context, summarizing it, converting formats. Sometimes you'll get a leak of a big database, like recently 13,000 members of the British National Party, a neo-Nazi party in the UK. Some people took this and turned this into a Google Maps mashup, or a density maps mashup. Other people in British press wrote articles about this. Then on the more technological front, helping us stay up in the face of censorship attacks, that can be legal assistance, assistance in fundraising, running servers for us, housing servers for us in particular locations, setting up interesting BGP routes for us, running caching front ends. All these things that mean we're spread over multiple jurisdictions, that makes it extremely hard for any one jurisdiction to engage in a successful censorship attack. There is code to be written to help integrate that sort of anti-censorship technology, code to be written to help whistleblowers, so packages of Firefox, for example, which have better security than the normal versions of Firefox. People can also help by running Tor exit nodes. The project uses Tor and some other systems to help the anonymity of submitters, and also internally. And helping us with massaging of documents, or writing automated systems to strip metadata. So you might imagine everything that Wikipedia does, plus everything that a journalistic organization does, plus the anti-censorship and legal aspects. So there's room for almost everyone who wants to contribute. And people can look at the contact addresses. Certainly helping in the management in a particular region with great assistance. I mean, most of the people who run the day-to-day responsibilities, other than the core network stuff, are journalists, and very, very highly tasked. So there's often not much time left to manage volunteers. So people who have that management ability, certainly very valued.
You mentioned internet censorship. Why is it a threat for freedom of expression or your work with whistleblowers?
So people on the internet proudly boast and proclaim that the internet cannot be censored. And this is a dangerous, dangerous fallacy. In fact, there's almost nothing easier to censor than the internet. We have seen numerous examples, and I'll give you a particular strong case from this year, where three British newspapers and one British current affairs weekly removed information from their archives, published stories that were published in print, removed them from their electronic archives completely, with no trace that they were ever there. That's not possible to do with libraries, as an example. The expenses are too high. But with centralized electronic archives, this is very easy. We've also seen our material electronically censored by or removed after threats of legal action from Dig and Reddit and Wikipedia, Wikinews. Amongst the German press, there's been people that have been too scared to link to some of our articles. Quite interesting, I think, not for any genuine legal reason, but they just feel that authority would not like that information coming out, so they may talk about what's in the article, but what's in the document, but not actually link to it. amongst the sort of censorship systems which Beijing, sorry, China is famous for, you can have real-time proactive censorship of the internet, and this is not just a Chinese problem. This may have been mostly a Chinese problem once, but these sort of systems have aggressively spread not just to places like Thailand and Saudi Arabia, but to Western countries as well. There's a proposal to introduce such a system to Australia. There's already pseudo-voluntary versions of this in Denmark, in Switzerland, in Sweden, in the United Kingdom, and in Canada. Ostensibly for censoring access attempts to child pornography, but the system itself is capable of censoring any web page. And the degree to which it censors only child pornography is only a degree to how secure the political system is from abuse. And with the censorship lists being secret, you cannot tell whether that system is being abused or not. And at the very moment when the system, when a political system stops being transparent and opens itself up to abuse, is the moment when you need freedom of speech the most. So the Fourth Estate, journalists, bloggers, can reveal the problems of government and problems in society. When those problems occur, the censorship systems, which have already been established for child pornography, will be used to censor other things, and Thailand is a clear-cut case of that. Its censorship system was set up a few years ago to censor child pornography, but in the past year has been used exclusively to censor political content. We have leaked the lists for Thailand for several years, and also Denmark and Turkey. And the Thai censorship list, it is all political content. You can see the URLs. It's actually a remarkable collection. You can see precisely what it is that the government doesn't want you to see.
Oh, it gets the same debate now in Germany with child pornography in the beginning.
It's a hard to argue against, you know. The people who are pushing... There's now actually an industry to sell these censorship systems. It is lobbying to have them introduced. And of course, if you oppose them, the argument is, well, you support child pornographers or abusive children. People don't realise that once these systems are established, they can be instantly, within hours, if there's the political will, used to censor other information. An example, European example of this is in Finland, where the Finnish child pornography censorship system was used to censor the web page of an anti-censorship activist. So that's an example of corruption in the system. You don't know that corruption is occurring until these lists are leaked because they're kept secret. So the government should not be keeping secret censorship lists from its adult population. Extremely dangerous to have these systems in place.
Yes, thank you very much for the interview, and good luck with your work in the future.
Thanks.